I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Cost of a private jet from Dallas to Washington to attend inaugural festivities? $20,000. The underwriter's package, 80 inaugural tickets and lunch with the commander-in-chief, $250,000. Getting that close to the president? Priceless. There is another perspective. Round-trip Greyhound ticket from Cambridge to Washington, $132. Cost of a case of beer in exchange for the privilege of crashing on a friend's couch, $18. Protesting against this president at his inauguration, priceless. Well, whatever the day means to you, the moment when a president accepts the call of voters to serve is one of the few moments when Americans indulge in national political pageantry. This hour on The Connection, we mark the occasion with reports from Washington and an assessment of what this day means to this president and this country. We'd like to have you join us. What is the inauguration to you? Is it a simple celebration of democracy? A time to step past the partisan angst of the recent election? Or a fierce demonstration of corporate and partisan excess? And what does the tone of the celebration reveal about this president and his agenda for the next term? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today's program with NPR's Washington correspondent, Pam Fessler. Pam covers Homeland Security, and today she is outside with others waiting for the inauguration. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Where are you exactly?
Well, right now I'm standing on the west side of the Capitol, and I'm outside the security checkpoint where those people who have the green and gold tickets have to go through to be screened.
And these people with the green and golds, they're going to be how close to the actual swearing-in?
They're going to be able to see it. I would say they're going to be maybe 400 yards or so away. The people with the blue tickets actually get to be closer. Right now I'm looking at just hundreds and hundreds of people streaming down towards the checkpoints. They're long lines, but they're actually going fairly quickly. They have TSA screeners from the airports.
Yeah.
They're actually doing the screening today, and they're mostly doing pat-downs of people. They're making people open their coats, and they're also looking through bags.
What are the rules on what you can take in and what you can't, Pam?
Well, there's a lot of things you can't take in. You can't take in large bags. You can't take in umbrellas. You can't take in strollers. You can't take in weapons of any kind. They even have on the long list of prohibited items laser pointers. But one of the most interesting things here is they also said that women cannot have pocketbooks that are larger than 4 by 8 inches, which are actually quite small. And there are a lot of women here who are being turned away and told to deposit their pocketbooks, either to throw them out, bring them back to their cars, or to just leave them in a big pile and pick them up later.
You could sort through one and maybe pick up a new one there, Pam.
Yeah, there's quite a pile, actually.
Well, tell me what the mood is of the people. Is there sort of eye-rolling resignation about the security, or are people pretty pumped up about what the day will be?
I think it's the latter. They're definitely pumped up. I've talked to a lot of people about the security, and at least these people here who are ticketed viewers for the swearing-in, most of them are very resigned to it. They say, well, this is what you have to do in this day and age. And in fact, some actually seem very comforted by it. I've had one or two people, especially the women who have to leave their pocketbooks, who have been upset about it. And even though we do see there's some helicopters overhead and there are a lot of police cars and motorcades going by, generally the security presence is not that intense.
All right, Pam, enjoy yourself. Try to stay warm. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
NPR's Washington correspondent, Pam Fessler. Now, this is also a time when Washington welcomes people from outside the Capitol, in this case mainly Republicans with money in their wallets and partying on their mind. George Terpolowski is general manager of the Fairmont Washington.
The hotel is certainly in a very festive mode. We actually have a beautiful inaugural chocolate display set up by our pastry chefs in one of the corners in the lobby, and then we have a beautiful courtyard in the middle of our hotel, which sort of the lobby wraps around, and we've illuminated it in red, white, and blue colors. So the uplighting is very dramatic in the middle of the hotel, and obviously the hotel is looking as good as it ever has.
I'm wondering if there is anything particularly Texas about your preparations for this inauguration, either to welcome Texans or to honor the home state of the president.
Well, you know, we tried to be bipartisan, even at a time of the year where traditionally mostly Republicans are attending the festivities, but there are still a lot of Democrats in the city. Having said that, we have, as part of our inaugural turndown amenities, presented several cookies that are a special recipe that has been produced by Laura Bush, and there's a little menu card attached to them, so when you go home, you can actually make them when you get back.
Have you tried one of these cookies yourself?
I have. They're actually very good, as you would expect.
I want you to tell me about your idea of President for a Day, the President for a Day package at the Fairmont.
Right. Well, this is sort of a whimsical idea that we put together, knowing that the people that are attending these festivities and staying in a hotel such as ours tend to be people who are sort of used to staying in luxury hotels and travel extensively. It's a package that features a night in our presidential suite, which is up on the gold floor of the hotel. This is a very private, exclusive floor that's manned by our concierge staff. And prior to the festivities, the inauguration day festivities, the couple would be treated to his and hers in-room massages. The first lady would be pampered by a hairstylist, makeup artist, and manicurist. And, of course, no presidential weekend would be complete without the Secret Service. So we have two actors who are Secret Service agents who will accompany the couple throughout the special weekend and follow them around the city, making sure that everything goes smoothly.
These are tall, broad-shouldered men with little plastic wires coming out of one ear?
That's correct, and the ubiquitous dark glasses. So
I've always wanted to have people like that follow me around.
Trust me, so do I.
How much would it cost to be president for a day?
Well, the actual charge, including the presidential suite, is $10,000 per night with a four-night minimum. And, obviously it includes a lot of other features, a state reception in the suite with Beluga caviar and Dom Perignon for 10 people, including the couple and constituents and friends. And then they're whisked off by a chauffeured Rolls-Royce to attend the inauguration festivities. And then when the president and the first lady for a day return to their presidential quarters, we host a magnificent midnight buffet for 10 served by the hotel's executive chef.
Now, have you got this locked down? Has somebody taken this package yet, George?
You know what? Somebody has not taken the package because when it came closer and closer to the dates, we ended up selling the three presidential suites, and then people sort of tailor their own activities, which include chauffeured town cars and limousines and special meals that we're preparing. But the concept of the package is to throw the concept out into the marketplace and then for people to be intrigued by the idea of being treated royally when they come for the inauguration. And then, as very often happens, people paying these kind of prices then tend to mandate their own individual preferences and tastes.
So that means the Secret Service guys are still available?
Secret Service guys are still available.
And I could post them outside the door of the studio if I was willing to pay the price?
To pay the price and you wanted to get a little special attention.
George, I wish you the best for the inauguration ceremonies. I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure, Dick. Anytime.
All right. All the best to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
George Terpilowski is general manager of the Fairmont Washington. He spoke to us a little bit earlier. We're joined now by Martha Joint Kumar. She's in the NPR studio in Washington. She's a professor of political science at Towson University. Martha, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You know that there are a lot of people who are shaking their heads or wagging their fingers over the amount of money that gets spent on something like this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think this is an important event that brings all the branches of government together, that the inaugural is something very special, that often you have a warring between the Congress, the president, and the courts. And this is the one occasion where all of them come together, where the Chief Justice is the one who delivers the oath. You have it taking place on the Capitol, at the Capitol, and then the luncheon is given by the members of Congress. And so it is a solemn and, in a sense, a sacred event as well. And there has been celebration for a very long time with the parade and the inaugural balls. That's been very much a tradition, and I think that people accept that, and the fact that it's paid for out of private funds makes it a lot easier, I think, for people to take. If it were the people's money, then you might hear a lot of grumbling about it, but I think that people generally feel that the president has a right to celebrate after a very hard-fought campaign.
Do you share the observation that this is perhaps the one moment where the where American politicians allow themselves that certain level of pageantry that we normally only associate with royalty, the sort of thing the founding fathers wanted to be so far away from?
Yes, and I think it's a very American pageantry too, where we have parades, fireworks. George Washington in his first inaugural that took place in New York, that after the oath taking, they went to St. Paul's Chapel for a special prayer service. But then they had a giant fireworks display that ended the evening. So I think that you've had a celebratory and a solemn tone is part of it from the beginning. And parades were very much a part of it from the latter part of the 19th century. And the balls have long been a tradition as well.
The idea that something like this should not happen while the country's at war, that's been much chewed over as well.
That's true, too. If you go back to Roosevelt's swearing in his fourth term, it is true that it was done at the White House. But also, I think one of the things that has not been mentioned about that, yes, it was wartime, but also the president was very ill. He was sworn in on January 20th, and he died in early April.
So it was done more in deference to his health. Martha,
so
I'm just going to stop you there for half a sec, because we do have to take a short break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. Looking ahead to today's inauguration, what is it to you? What does the tone of the celebration reveal about this president and his agenda for the next term? We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the inauguration. It is certainly the talk of the country today. President Bush to be inaugurated to begin his second term as president. Martha Joynt Kumar is with us from the NPR studios in Washington. She is a professor of political science at Towson University, something of a specialist in presidential transition and inaugurations, this moment that comes by once every 4 years. We'd like to hear what you're thinking today. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We're taking a call from Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and it's Matt on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I think I know myself and many people I know view the inauguration as sort of a day of mourning, that we feel, you know, this president is not really representative of us, and that, you know, it's sort of a day of sadness.
Are you quarreling with the election results, or are you just sort of feeling sad that your side lost?
Well, there's probably a combination of the two, but also just the, you know, the sort of the record of the past 4 years. It's sort of, to me, it's really a day of mourning, more that it shows how easily sort of manipulated, I think, the American population can be as far as putting someone back in office who's really done a pretty poor job and really, you know, helped to, you know, create a lot of problems globally. You know.
Matt, I want you to stay on the line with me for half a sec, if you would, because I'm going to bring in another call. Melissa's on the line from Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. You are also not a big fan of this president, I gather.
Oh, dreadfully no.
But what do you make of this day?
Well, I think that the day of mourning was the final election results, and I was disappointed and I was scared for our future in that sense. I think the inauguration of the President of the United States is an absolute day of celebration. It's the one thing we've got going for us, is that we know how to cast some votes, deal with the results, even if we dispute them or disagree with them, but then get on with the business of the day, which is to run our lives and show how a democracy is done. And we'll have our chance in 4 more years. I do take issue with the total financial total of the events. And
right.
And could some things be done differently? I like the idea that I heard at the start of the show that there will be some events for some of the soldiers, some of the wounded, the people who really need a celebration more than anyone.
Melissa, what would you say to someone like Matt, though, who does not share your observation that the inaugural day is kind of a nonpartisan event?
Well, I would disagree. I would say it's nonpartisan in that we all agree that this is the President of the United States, and we have our channels for disagreeing, for blocking bad decisions or trying to, for taking part in the process. And just after a deep breath and celebrating that we know how to make a transition peacefully, which is still, if you look around, one of the rarest things on this planet.
Matt, what do you think?
And move on and do the work.
Well,
and elect someone new next time.
Well, for me, you know, I agree with some of the points, but also there's a lot of people who are not in consensus about the celebration of the inauguration. There's a lot of people protesting across the globe, not only in the United States. So a lot of people are saying, no, thank you. You know, this is not representing us. This is not being a proactive, positive step for our planet, essentially. So, and my concern, too, with some of the protesting is that we will see, as far as, you know, the general media system, very little reporting about it.
I'm going to stop you there if I can, Matt. I want to go back to Martha Joynt Kumar and just, Martha, for your observation, this idea that the inauguration ends up being something of a continuation of an election that was settled back in early November. Is that new? Is that novel this time around?
Well, it's important that we understand that you win sometimes and you lose, and what you end up having to do is accept the fact that we lost, that one lost the election. You can go back to 1801 is the first time that we had a change in parties and established the fact that whoever wins in the electoral vote is going to win the presidency, and what your options then are is to form a coalition that will win in the next election. And think of the supporters of George H.W. Bush, who lost in the 1992 election and then worked at seizing the presidency, which they did after Clinton left office. And so I think the caller is right that you just accept it and then work on trying to make a change. But there'll be protesters in Washington today. There'll be reminders that the president will see that that not everybody wanted him to be president. And he's going to be very aware of it with members of Congress. He can certainly see it in the nomination of Condoleezza Rice and the questioning that she got. So there are a lot of critics that are in the government.
Let's hear from Carl Cannon, who's been listening in for the past few moments on the telephone. Carl is White House correspondent for the National Journal, and he's joining us from his office in Washington. Hi, Carl.
Mr. Gordon, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm interested in, you have, what, this is your sixth inaugural, is that right?
Well, I've never taken the oath myself, but I've covered that many.
You can mouth the words along with the president. You can all pretend. I'm just curious if I can ask you, because you've been watching this sort of thing, if you can contrast 2000 to 2004, when we talk about the inaugural being a time for people to kind of celebrate democracy or continue whatever partisan side they're on here. How do you make a comparison between the two?
Well, that young fellow who called in and told you that he thought it was a day of mourning, I can't. I've been a journalist so long, and I was born into a journalist family. I can hardly relate to that. To me, it's a day of happiness, and I say that whoever is the president. I guess I didn't feel that way in 1969 when I was a young, long-haired college kid, and Nixon took the oath. But so I understand that. But look, this thing, Bush won in 2000 barely. You know, he didn't even have a plurality of the vote. A lot of people didn't think he was even a legitimate president. He went ahead, he stiff upper lip and had the inaugural balls and had the inauguration and gave the most conciliatory inaugural address in 40 years, according to Rick Hertzberg of The New Yorker, who wrote Carter's inaugural address. So Rick is no slouch at analysis. But there was a sense in that inauguration that this guy was a one-term president, that he'd gotten in by a fluke. It's not that way this time. And Bush, and one of the reasons Bush is going in for, you know, all this wretched excess, and I say that in quotes because they're all wretched excess, is because he knows he's really the president now, and he won, and he's happy.
So the character of this inaugural, you're saying that it is, in fact, a more accurate or better reflection of the character of this president?
Well, I think from their standpoint, they're really entitled to this party. I noticed that Bill Clinton agreed with me. He told that to Larry King Live. Larry King asked Clinton some of the questions you've asked Martha and Melissa and this other gentleman who called in have addressed. And he said, look, these guys won. They're entitled to do anything they want. But from historic terms, mean, if you got another minute, this is not, they're all like this. You know, Eisenhower came in wartime and specifically asked the party to have a sort of low-key inaugural address. It turns into the biggest, flashiest one they've ever had. It included Alaskan dog team and elephants and a float with Ike playing golf. And by the time the...
Was this when he got lassoed as well?
Yeah, there's a cowboy from California who ran through the rope around Eisenhower, who, you know, the general was not used to that kind of thing. But he smiled, you know, for the cameras. That was the first one televised. But this is what happens, and it's because and this woman who called you, Melissa, she gets it. It's because it's not a celebration of George Bush beating John Kerry. It's a celebration of 200 years of democracy.
1-800-423-8255. We're interested in knowing how you're seeing what today is. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina for our next call, and Neenan's joining us from there. Hi, Neenan.
Hi there.
Tell me what you think.
Well, I was saying that I was a high school English teacher, and we're out of school today because of a fluke snowstorm yesterday. And I'm going to tape the speech, even though I don't necessarily agree with Bush's politics. I want my students to look at the speech from a rhetorical and oratorical standpoint, because second inaugurals are traditionally not very good. And I think, however, that this president has hit his stride, and it's going to be a fairly good speech. But I also look at it from the point of view, I want my students to know that this is a change. This is what we do in America. We inaugurate presidents, and we do not have to physically remove anybody from the White House. We don't have to have tanks.
Yeah.
And I agree with previous caller. You know, this is a true form of our democracy.
Martha, you will no doubt also be talking with students about what this inaugural speech represents. How do you take it apart? Do you look at it from a rhetorical, how is the president delivering his message point of view, or are you also picking it apart for content?
Well, you look at it for how the president sees the United States within the world, what he wants our posture to be, what clues it gives about what he plans to do in the next 2 years, which will be fleshed out further in the State of the Union. But a second term inaugural address is different than a first, because in the first, you don't know who the president is. And so you're looking for clues as to who he is and what he intends to do. In the second term, you know who he is. You've gone through the 4 years, you've gone through the campaign, and you pretty much know who he is. And so I'm looking for his interest in trying to set a diplomatic tone with nations around the world, perhaps a somewhat different posture than he's had in this first 4 years, and also an indication that he is of his interest in working together with all members of Congress, not just Republicans. But, you know, one of the things to think here is that of the second-term presidents, he is the first one to have both parties, both houses of Congress controlled by his parties, that since 1951 of the five second-term presidents. So is he going to work with the Democrats as well as the Republicans, even though his party controls both houses?
I mean, we have to know that the president is trying to imagine, or has been trying to imagine, whether or not he or his speechwriters can construct a line or create an image that will live on past him, so people might someday refer back to the Bush second inaugural. Is that a part of taking a look at the language of it for you and your students in Raleigh?
Absolutely. That's one of the things I've asked them to do, is look for memorable lines. And I use the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans as an example. And my students have been studying social justice and the great orators and Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King. So this is a wonderful culmination of that unit.
Carl, what are the chances that there's going to be that memorable line in this speech?
Well, I'm not sure a single line is what we ought to be listening for. But what Martha was talking about is a tone. I mean, what she said about the second inaugural being different from the first, Lincoln began his second inaugural with that very thought. He said, if I remember correctly, at this second appearing to take the oath of presidential office, there is less occasion for an extended address than there was in the first. So Lincoln put it that simply. But then he went on to give a really important thought, and he used the Old Testament, he used biblical language, and he said, he basically said that both sides pray to the same God, you know, and he's talking about the North and the South, but then you know, invoked Isaiah to say, but it seems strange that someone would you know, use the sweat of another man's brow to get his wealth. And he was basically saying that the South's reading of the Bible and of the Constitution was a perversity, and that slavery was a perversity. And so it's not one line. It's an important thought I'd be looking for. And I guess I don't know what I'm looking for. The speech is in a couple of hours. But I think Martha said he has to appeal to Democrats, and I suspect he really needs to talk to the world as well. The State of the Union, he can talk to the Democrats. I think he needs to assure the world that this desire for freedom is not just a line he uses to mobilize American troops, but something he deeply believes. I think he has to find a way to say what he's said before and get people to believe it.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Alex is with us. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
It's a very sad day for me. I'm one of the people that can't bear to watch this coronation, and I'm disturbed, and, you know, I do find it offensive, such a lavish celebration, you know, when our country is facing such solemn times. I mean,
Alex, right, let me just set aside the amount of money that is spent on it for a moment and talk about the content of the speech. If the president spent some time sitting at his desk thinking about people like Alex in Portsmouth and how he has to reach out to those who are so opposed to him, are you willing to give him, you know, enough time to at least say, hey, this is what I have to say to you?
To be honest, Dick, to me, actions speak a lot louder than words. And I think that the thinking that this president needs to appeal to the Democrats today, I don't think it's happening. I mean, the fact is we you know, the half this country almost is polarized against the man in the administration. And I think that the ambitious agenda that he has already set out upon, which he knows is, you know, very contrary to what half this population believes in, things like dismantling Social Security and, you know, things like that. I think that, you know, his actions, so he's not going to act in a conciliatory way today in words or actions.
Let me turn to Carl on that one, Alex, because if we look ahead, Carl, at some of the things that are proposed for the legislative agenda that come from this president, such as dramatic changes he's thinking about for Social Security, then it does end up being a political speech, right?
Well, but partly we need to be careful, even on your show, and I don't mean to admonish your callers. They're good Americans who know as much about public policy as I do. But when we use phrases like dismantle Social Security for you know, you could say, you could use the phrase incremental reforms to try and strengthen it if you wanted to play that rhetorical game. Bush is not going to be able to appeal to people who detest him so much that they're close-minded, or that they're sore losers, or that they won't even listen to what he has to say. That's not really – he can't change their minds. But I will agree with this woman who says that – but he can take different – he can change his policies. Now, he can moderate his approach somewhat. He can't do that today. Today's a rhetorical day, and he has to – for the people who are listening, he has to convey the sense that he's listening and that he understands that only slightly more than half this country believes what he's doing, and that he's got to try and bring those other half into the fold a little bit. So that's a pretty tall order. If I had the magic bullet for that, I'd probably be over there writing speeches.
You use the word rhetorical in the best sense, too, here, don't you?
Yes.
It's not a dismissive.
Communication. Martha Kumar, who you have on there, who probably knows more about this than any living American, but she can tell you, you know, presidential rhetoric, it's an important part of the job.
All right, Connection listeners, what is today to you? Is it the celebration of a country's democracy? Is it an opportunity? Does this president provide an opportunity to see past the partisan bitterness that we watched all the way through the election campaign? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. We are looking ahead to the president's second inaugural address due in a little less than an hour and a half from now. We've talked about the party preparations in Washington, the 500,000 people who are there in that city. We also want to broaden the conversation out a little bit to those of us who are not in Washington and still looking at how this speech might mark this president, how people will write and think about it in years ahead. We'd like to have you in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Carl Cannon is with us. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. And Martha Joynt Kumar is also with us. She's professor of political science at Towson University. Martha, just help us with a bit of context, if you would. I want you to sort of pick up where Carl was talking just before the break here. We have the country deeply divided over the war in Iraq, and it seems pretty deeply divided over the current state of the economy and the plans that are ahead. So to what extent can a president use rhetoric and tone to shift that, to change that? Is it possible?
It is important if he has to, obviously has to back it up with actions. But an inaugural is a time when the public is actually watching. They're going to stop and they're going to listen. And so it gives an opportunity to switch gears from the harsh rhetoric of a campaign where you were focusing on winning over your opposition and painting them in the worst kind of way and seeing the world in, or the political world in terms of black and white. It's an opportunity to switch gears to governing, where you are going to need the help of everyone. And so what he says are going to be clues, but those are clues that we're going to then use to watch him to see what he actually does. So his agenda and his actions are going to be the important thing, but the inaugural address gives us a clue of what he sees, what he's thinking, and what his priorities are. And as Carl was talking about, the place in the world that the U.S. has, and what is his vision, like his vision of the importance of liberty, and that he sees the war in Iraq as a part of his vision to bring democracy to the Middle East, and the importance that he sees of bringing freedom around the world. And then he sees it also as the unifying element in his domestic agenda, which he calls the ownership society, where he wants to bring freedom to the individual to make certain types of choices, such as the Social Security.
And how does the president then imagine an audience for this speech, Carl? If he knows that he has to address some issues that are important to those people who put him in office, but he's also thinking, okay, this speech is going to be translated into Arabic and run in clips on Al Jazeera. I mean, can he square all that at the same time?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. John F. Kennedy realized, was the first president to realize, that an American president's speeches were translated instantly around the world, and they talked about it in that White House. Martha has, in fact, written about this. But they, when they're talking on the inaugural address, yes, they're talking to an audience of people. Their target audience is not the people who voted for him. It's people who just are watching with an open mind, whether or not they voted for him. He's not really talking to the people who vote for any Republican. Mm-hmm. He's not really talking to the person who would vote for any Democrat. He's talking to the rest of us. And that, I've talked to their speechwriters, and they try to keep that sort of everyman person in mind. Karen Hughes was ridiculed for this during the first campaign, but I actually think it's a good way to look at it. In terms of the foreign audience, what they have to do, and they've learned this the hard way, is they've got to think about images that don't translate well. And I'll leave you with one word. Crusades is not a word that turned out to translate well. They have to be careful about that kind of thing.
Martha, do you want to add something to that?
No, I think that's a good note there.
I'm just wondering in terms of how of finding that audience or finding the language for that audience. I don't know whether or not they would go so far as to say, you know, this is a part of the speech. We're told it's what, 17 minutes long. This is a part of the speech that goes here and this goes there.
Sure, they do that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that you may make it short, and then that gives less opportunity for everyone to chop it up and see it in their own way. And so it is short and has a greater possibility of the whole thing being translated and used.
May I jump in here for a minute?
Yeah, go ahead.
All presidents that I'm familiar with think of themselves, and this is their great strength, as one of the people. I mean, this goes back to Jacksonian days, and it sounds silly. You know, Kennedy raised the way he was, and Reagan, and even Roosevelt. Roosevelt used to go tell farmers in the South, I am one of you. I have a farm. He was talking about Hyde Park, you know. But if there's a beauty in that. They really do think they're talking to their fellow people who are like them. And I think this helps them when they remember that. I wanted to add that thought.
But let me take it another step further, because if you look at some of the more highly regarded inaugural speeches, what comes through in kind of bold capitals is a humility. Is the president trying to express precisely that sort of, I am one of you? And, a couple of days ago when we were doing the Rice confirmation, there was that kind of fist-banging frustration from the Democrats. Why won't you even admit that maybe you made a mistake here? And I'm wondering if within that fairly tightly wound administration, there is that capacity for the kind of humility that you're talking about.
Well, let me say, yes, there is. And you're on to something. Look, the Condi, when Barbara Boxer is accusing Condi Rice of being callous towards the soldiers who've died in Afghanistan, that's what she did. And when she accused Condi Rice of seeing the tsunami only in terms of a public relations opportunity for America, that's a fairly ugly accusation. Mm-hmm. In that format, Condi Rice is not to throw herself on the mercy of Barbara Boxer. But there are times that this president has had an opportunity to say things like that. One of them was the second debate in St. Louis. Have you ever made a mistake? And he refuses. He sort of stops short of it. He later went up to the woman who said that in that town hall meeting in St. Louis and said, oh, I know you were talking about Iraq. They're always trying to use that question to get me to admit I was wrong about Iraq. And the woman had very carefully phrased her question, she thought, so that Bush wouldn't think that, because she didn't mean that. She meant what you're talking about. This is a problem of theirs. But if you go back and read, and it's worth doing, Bush's first inaugural, he talks a lot about humility. He gets this. And one of the problems he's had with people like, I think, I can't remember their names, but I think Nina and some of these other callers who called in, was that he doesn't act like a humble person. And one of the qualities of humility is a willingness to admit fault. So I think this is a central tension in this guy, and it comes out in these speeches. The speech may have that kind of language in it, but then it's incumbent on him to back that up with some humble actions as well.
1-800-423-8255. Next call from Walterboro, South Carolina. John's joining us. John, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. I just think today is a good day for the president. It's kind of his day. I'm proud that we in this country have an opportunity to celebrate this day, as a lot of callers and your guests have explained that it's symbolic of our freedom, and I'm appreciative of that. I think the president has done a pretty good job. He's not perfect. He's made mistakes. But I think he has been sincere with his effort to defend the sovereignty of this country and those that would challenge, whether it be here or abroad. And I appreciate that, and I stand by him with his efforts to do that and continue that.
Now, John, you know there are going to be people in Washington there to protest against this president at his inauguration. Is that the sort of thing where you sort of go, yeah, well, you're free to do that too if you want, or do you think that they're missing the point somehow on what an inauguration is supposed to be if it is that kind of day to celebrate democracy rather than just one man?
You know, it's the right of the people of this country, and I respect that. Just the part that bothers me is do they put forth the same energy, yeah, the same effort to help their fellow man? That's the part that I wonder. You know, I'm not challenging and saying they don't do that, but quite often I see folks complain, and they don't do. And I can say that because I try to go out and do and help my fellow man. So I'm not, you know, saying something that I don't support. But that's my only fault. So as long as they're out there also with that same energy level trying to give back to their fellow man, more power to them.
All right. Thanks for your call, John. Martha or Carl, your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I was president of the White House Correspondents Association last year, and I had to give a speech with Bush sitting right beside me. And I said right there, I said that I wanted people to understand what reporters are like, that we would be just as happy to cover John Kerry's first term as George Bush's second. And then I made a joke and said, you know, if we're lucky enough to be on the beat, we'd be just happy to cover a third Clinton term. And Hillary was in the audience. But last night I was sitting at my desk watching the fireworks over the first fireworks display of the inauguration, and I can see them from my desk. And I remember that thinking that, you know, that's the kind of thing all reporters have to say. But I really meant it, and I felt it, and I thought if those fireworks were going off and Kerry was president, they would look just as great to me. And I guess what I would urge all these callers is just to feel good about this day. And, you know, dissent is just as much a part of the American tradition as anything else. Even the protesters on this inauguration, I'm happy they're there too. But I think that they should be happy they're there, if you follow what I'm saying.
No, I think that you and John are pretty well agreeing on that. Martha, did you want to jump in?
I believe that too. And the opposition is very much a part of large gatherings. That when there's a large political gathering, opposition is there, whether it's the party conventions, but at the big moments like the inaugurals, you certainly saw that during the Vietnam War, and that's the freedom of expression. It's very much a part of what our system is, and reminds people of that.
Let's go to Portsmouth, Virginia for our next call. Thomas is joining us on the line from there. Thomas, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Tell me if you're in agreement with my guests on this point.
Sometimes. But I think I've failed to see how an inauguration has to do with democracy. It's a party for the fat cats. As he said, his power base is the have and the have-mores. And
I heard a story on NPR yesterday about kids, university kids who campaigned for Bush in Iowa, sort of piling in a car and driving off to Washington for the inauguration. Now, I get it, Thomas. These kids don't have their $250,000 to have lunch with the commander in chief. I'm not I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that is it really just for those fat cats?
I think the majority of the people you're going to see are not young college kids. But my question about the whole thing is why should we believe what he says this time? We made the mistake of believing before. Heck, I voted for him the first time, and I don't feel like a sore loser this time because I voted against him. I just felt like I was stabbed in the back. When he was campaigning, he said he was the great compromiser and very honest, and none of that came out. So he says one thing, and he does another, and that's why I'm very sad that he's back in.
Martha, I wonder if this president has, in fact, raised the bar to an almost unreachable level for himself, for precisely what Thomas is talking about, his promise to unite and his inability. I think that's probably a fair observation, his inability to deliver on that in his first term.
And he's talked about that he's seen that as was one of the failures, as the failure to change the tone in Washington. And there has been a much more bitter tone in Washington for not just his presidency, but preceding it as well. And that's one of the challenges that he's going to have. If you've seen the Democrats have taken the position that they're going to oppose him on just about everything. But I don't think that's going to work very well for them either, because you need to have something to oppose with, and to just stand in opposition. I don't think it's going to be very productive for the Democrats in terms of building a coalition to govern in the future.
Carl, your thoughts on that?
Well, the caller from Portsmouth, Virginia, felt let down by Bush's presidency after, I presume, being inspired by his first inauguration. That's something I'm not going to defend Bush on. He's going to have to do that himself.
Yeah.
He said in that first inaugural address, he said, civility is not a tactic or a sentiment. It is the determined choice of trust over cynicism. Now, Bush thinks he lived up to that and the Democrats didn't, but I would submit that the president is the person who really controls the agenda, whatever his critics are saying, and that he has to use another biblical admonition that he'd be familiar with. I mean, he needs to turn the other cheek, and he needs to win back people like this gentleman from Portsmouth, Virginia.
Yeah.
And today's speech is a start, but that's just the start.
I wonder if 2 or 3 years from now we'll look at this second inaugural speech as a yardstick to measure how successful he was, both at at reaching beyond the partisan divide that we've talked about, but also in achieving some of what he thinks the country needs in his second term. Will we look back at that, or do we set it aside? Does it stand somehow apart? Do we look more at the State of the Union speeches? Carl, can you start on that?
Yes. I think my opinion about this, and the subject that we're talking about, is very dear to me, but I actually think it's secondary. One of the reasons some of these callers find it disquieting to have an elaborate inauguration during a time of war is because the war is what really matters. And I think Bush's legacy is now so entwined so deeply with Iraq, I think we'll remember what happens there, but it will color our perception of him and even our perception of this day. Things yet to happen, we're going to determine how we look back on this speech is my prediction.
Go ahead, Martha.
I think we'll look at it in terms of judging his foreign policy, of his achievements. We'll look at it as an image of where he wanted the United States to be in its relationships with its neighbors in the world, and then how far has he been able to bring us there? Has he been able to achieve the liberty? What has happened in Iraq? What has happened as far as democracy in the Middle East? Those are all basic goals for him.
And is that, are you saying that, Martha, in terms of a correction in the direction that he's taken the country in the first term, or in a much sort of broader sense about where America is at the beginning of this century?
Well, I think that he's thinking in terms of the U.S.'s position in the world and as a leader in bringing about liberty, because he's going to be using the word liberty on several occasions in this speech, and bringing about democracy in the Middle East. You know, that is his goal for Iraq. And so in 2 years, we'll look back in the speech and see to what extent was he able to bring about what he wanted, or did other people share his vision, including people in the United States.
Well, maybe we should get the two of you together to do that in a couple of years. Martha, thanks for being with us on the program today.
You're welcome.
Martha Joynt Kumar is professor of political science at Towson University. And Carl Cannon, it's nice to have you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dick.
Carl is White House correspondent for the National Journal. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Pam Fessler, NPR correspondent who covers Homeland Security, and George Terpolowski, general manager of the Fairmont Washington. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenelosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.